Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas Podcast with my very special guest, Gianpiero Petroglieri. Gianpiero is an Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior at INSEAD Business School. Previously a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, his expertise is on leadership and his passion is on humanizing organizations. His work has been featured in a range of media, including the BBC, Financial Times, The Economist, The Guardian, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, El País, and much more. And he is listed among the 50 most influential management thinkers in the world by Thinkers 50. Gianpiero, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me, Simon. It's great to be here.
Good. I want to ask you an open question to start with, Gianpiero. Just what's on your mind at the moment with what's going on in the world and where we are? What's kind of foremost on your mind at the moment?
That is a very big question. I guess what's foremost in my mind is, how do we keep in mind that we have a lot more in common than we think? You know, it's a crisis is a very peculiar situation, and it is a unique crisis, right? Because it's an existential crisis. And I've come to think of it as a kind of a midlife crisis of the sort of worldview of lifestyle that we used to hold. At every single level, we are questioning, is what we did sustainable? You know, at the kind of broader institutional level, you know, at the organizational level, are organizations fair? At the personal level, you know, will we be able to get back to work in the way we used to work before? And I think when you have a moment like this, when there's crisis, and we're also, you know, now we've been going through the pandemic for the last 12 months, you've seen a lot of political turmoil associated as a result, amplified by that, I don't know what. And when you have a moment like this, I mean, we know people can really take two directions. They yeah. can become very, very defensive and polarized, and we have enough data to see that, you know, we're going in that direction. But also, you know, people sometimes really kind of turn inwards and question, is this really it? Maybe we can do it a different way. And actually a crisis can become a moment in which we take a developmental leap. And so, you know, all I'm preoccupied with is what can we do to nudge ourselves as individuals, our relationships, our organizations, the kind of larger system, if you don't want to be too grandiose, to nudge it more towards the developmental use of this existential moment rather than to a defensive one in which we kind of become more entrenched, more paranoid and more polarized as a result.
Sure, that's very nicely put, a midlife crisis for the world we live in. I'm with you. People ask me kind of which way do I think it's going to go in this split way? And I say, well, it's for us to fight for it. We have to work for it every day, well, every minute.
Yeah, it depends for whom. I think which way it's going to go assumes that it's going to go one way for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably won't, honestly. It probably won't. I think it's going to go one way for some and another way for others. And I think the more, and what I've come to think and what I'm thinking a lot about right now is for those who experience and have around them enough care, then it's probably going to go the developmental way. And for those who don't, for those who feel, you know, even more loosely attached and isolated, and then I think it's going to go more the polarized way. And so I think the question is, how do we make more people go the developmental way than, you know, go down the kind of paranoid and polarized way?
Sure, sure. And in your work with leaders, you work a lot with leaders in many different organizations, and you work experientially with them. How do you think it's possible to shape leadership? I mean, both of you and I work in the business schools and in leadership development, and we both critique a lot of the normative ways of working. How do you think you can shape leaders thinking and leadership?
I love what you say, Simon, as I think it's very accurately put. I think we should really focus on shaping leadership above and beyond shaping leaders. I think very often what you and I critique is the fact that we can invest a lot in developing leaders without questioning leadership at all. So we kind of take the traditional models for granted, and then we figure out how do we basically replicate the system? Like, how do we create more people that can enact those models competently? And then we kind of congratulate ourselves that we made people more competent and more skillful. And all we've done is actually consolidate an image that remains implicit and that, actually is not suited for what those people need. And so I think a lot of the work, I do, both conceptually and experientially, is really trying to surface what's the underlying image of leadership that orients my action, my actions as a teacher, my actions as a coach, my actions as a consultant, my actions as an author, but your actions as an executive, your actions as a manager, your action as a worker. Because at the end of the day, most of us are driven by some desire for consistency with an underlying internalized image of what's right and good. And that image might be more or less conscious. And when it comes to leadership, that image, frankly, has been a fairly, narcissistic one, if we want. It's the leader who gets other people, the kind of nicely dressed way is getting other people to do what they wouldn't otherwise do, which is a very poetic way of saying getting your way. Yeah. And we have these images at the core of leadership development, right? I speak about this as the kind of holy triad of leadership, that you have to have the vision of a saint, the strategy of a general, and the endurance of an athlete. And if you have these three things, everything will be all right, which means is you're going to get your way. Sure. And of course, in this moment, we realize, wow, that's good if you benefit from that. But for everyone who doesn't benefit from that view, isn't good. And so one of the things that I'm interested in a lot is how do we add a fourth element that has really been a little bit at the margin? Is how do we bring care? Right now, what we've done in leadership development, frankly, say, look, what matters is having your vision and the strategy and the persistence to achieve those goals, and then try to be a decent human being, right? On the side. It's like the side salad on the main course of instrumentality. And a lot of my work is like, could we make this the main course? Could we put care at the center and instrumentality as an expression of care? I'm not saying we don't need to get stuff done. Of course. But I think the question of who do we get stuff done for should be a lot more central than it traditionally is in images of leadership and in leadership development. And I think if you don't change the images, then you cannot change the training and you cannot change the practice. Because at the end of the day, it's all a sequence. There's some images that then inform what we write about, that then inform what we teach, that then inform what we practice.
I use the framework of leadership four discourses: the controller, the therapist, the messiah, and the eco-leadership.
Right.
What I find interesting is they're powerful images. So people understand the controller, and I say it's not all good or bad. We need people to do controller leadership. We need efficiency.
Absolutely.
We need some of this. We need good therapist leadership. We need kind of good people managers. We need caring managers. We need some vision. We need some strong cultures. We need some messiah in the system, and that's good. What people find difficult is to actually understand what eco-leadership is, or the shift from the individual leader to leadership. I think people find that hard to kind of get an image of that, and then they retreat back to what they know.
Well, because we're intoxicated, right? We're seduced by the individual. It's so seductive, the individual. I mean, we all have that, right? And I think to some degree we should understand, it has its place, that more individualistic, dependable, especially if done well, it's not even incompatible with a more systemic perspective. Yeah. If you have some good stewardship of a system, then, people look at you as a dependable steward of that, great. But I think the disconnect, I think very often what the trouble is, the disconnect between individuals, when people have a hard time grasping the concept of systemic leadership, it's because they live in an environment, whether it's a psychological, social environment, where they can't really experience the connection between individual and system. And so those two become opposite, and one becomes familiar and the other one becomes other. One becomes easy to get and the other one becomes difficult to grasp. And I get that all the time. Look, I get this idea of like, well, you know, this idea of images, underlying images, is kind of very psychological. It's very academic. It's not. It's the most practical thing. It's the most practical thing, because once you understand the image that is not just driving, but orienting you, then what you can start asking different questions. You know, a lot of, you know, as you say, a lot of people think like, well, does this model of leadership work or not? That's irrelevant. All models work. The question, once you understand the image that are driving you, is what work is that image doing?
Yes.
And what work is it doing for you? And what work is it doing to you? And I think that's where, I think, you know, you and I are sort of similar in that we tend to think of, you know, a big part of leadership development as not just self. I don't actually use the word self-awareness a lot. I think more of like expanding your consciousness, because it's awareness of self in a system, awareness of how some of your experiences are not just, you know, they're certainly part of your history and aspirations and your drives, but they're also functions of, you know, the soup, the kind of environment and opportunities you're in.
That's right. I mean, I hear myself repetitively saying to people, you know, society speaks through you. So it's not just you. Society speaks through you. You know, you can't separate yourself from the wider systems. And I think sharing personal stories and being personal is useful, bringing people's own experience in. And I was thinking about you and reading a bit about you before this interview, thinking about your Sicilian heritage and your cosmopolitan ideology.
Yeah.
That's nice. Now you're very you know on your Twitter you show your Sicilian cooking and your delight, but you're very cosmopolitan as well. Can you say something about that?
I think of myself. I mean, I think of identity a lot, and I write about it, and I also think about it reflexively. If I were to define myself in relation to territory, I would say I'm a European with strong Sicilian roots, with strong Italian roots, and Sicilian in particular. And look, I'm of a generation that came of age with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And, you know, my parents were children during World War II, and they both grew up in, you know, being the first in their families to go to university and still quite scarred by what they had seen and lived as a child. And I think that one of the things that their generation, and, you know, they became middle class. And I think for my parents, the signature experience of being middle class was being able to afford to send me abroad to study. And the message I grew up with, like, you have to go abroad, there was, you know, they were the generation that set up the Erasmus project and that, you know, send people like me to be an obnoxious teenager in London learning English. And I think that the principle that they were following was sound. You know, it's based on a lot of social psychology, which is if you study with kids from other cultures, if you hang out with them, if you make out with them, if you do business with them, it's going to be a lot harder to bomb them 30, 40 years later. And I give them a lot of credit, you know, and I think in Europe, about 60 years of peace because of that impulse that came from a profound pain. Okay, from having experienced the pain of the war. And so I grew up with that. And then I was a teenager and the Berlin Wall fell. And you had that moment of incredible idealism. And I was fortunate enough, when I graduated from high school, my parents gave me as a gift an Interrail ticket. And you could, you know, remember those, I think they still exist, those train tickets, you go all around the world. And I always say, you know, that was the social technology that shaped my mindset. Those overnight second class trains is what we did, is we would take the trains overnight because then you would save one night hostel fee, right? If you traveled overnight and so, and there would be, and sometimes you'd see these same kids, you know, that you would move from one place to the other. And to think about, you know, how much, and, you know, I remember being on one of the first buses that did the whole tour of West and East Berlin. And just like we sat on the bus and went around, and you had a sense that boundaries were evil and that, you know, we had won, like, you know, freedom had won, peace had won, you know, all that marvelous idealism. And then, of course, you know, things things haven't worked. You know, I think it's fair to say that the European ideal hasn't generated as much enthusiasm lately as I experienced in my early 20s. But certainly for me, you know, I was fortunate. It became then the whole impulse, okay, maybe I want to go somewhere for 6 months. And then I traveled abroad and I started studying abroad. And then I said 6 months turned into 6 years. And then I got the job I have now. And now I live in France. I married, you know, I married a woman, she's English, and she was born 20 miles from the little village where I first went to England to learn English. Wow. in Northern England. Like, she speaks the first accent I ever heard. And we made this life. And in many ways, you know, what's interesting, because her parents don't speak any Italian and my parents don't speak any English. And we've come to see them as very similar, you know, both kind of embracing this this post-World War II ideology. Will send kids, we want them to feel Europeans and all of that. So when this day I hear a lot, I mean, even my students say, like, you know, Europe always like is a failed ideological project. And I get what a failed economic project, and I really get what they say. But at the same time, it feels like, not really, like, you don't get it. That's like an identity that took us out. Yeah. From, it was an antidote to the principles that had gotten a lot of people killed in my parents' generation. And so what I've been wrestling with, of course, is what I think I ought to consider a generational failure on our side. Because if you think of the word cosmopolitan now, I mean, 20 years ago, the way I experienced it, it was, you know, it was an attitude of curiosity towards the other. That's what it meant. Yeah. But now cosmopolitan is like an elite identity, like it's people who kind of hang out in cities and, you know, get all the fine jobs. Yeah. And, you know, and now I'm studying this, you know, because honestly, I think there's a real dilemma. And especially when you work with organizations or corporations, because at the same time, you have this real tension between mobility has become not just a perk. You know, I experience it as an immense privilege and liberation, but now it's become a necessity. If you work in a large organization and you're not willing to move around, it's going to be very hard for you to progress to the senior level. And yet, at the same time, what we know from the social psychology of leadership is people want stability from their leaders. They want to know your wine of us. So in many ways, I wonder if in some ways we got a little bit carried away and we became a generation of people whose opportunities have come at the cost of their trustworthiness. And that's why you see me on, and Twitter is a good example, because for me, Twitter has always been, you know, an interesting experiment of trying to figure out, kind of bring the personal and the professional together, you know, not hide behind my sort of, you know, articles and my more, and, you know, and you see me trying to wrestle with what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to have had a life, to have had a career, to have had opportunities in a place other than that in which you were born? And obviously, you know, I'll go to my grave thinking that was a great thing. You know, I was realized. But I think, you know, as we're talking about midlife crisis, I've gotten to a point in my life where I can also see the risks.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying triggered memories for me, one of traveling and traveling without the internet and being without mobile phones. And when you were away, you were freed from the tethers of parents and stuff, and you took risk and you did stuff. And the other thing it sparked to me was the idea that I work with a lot of leaders, like global leaders, and coach them, and they travel, and this sort of global elite which travels around the world, they're not very cosmopolitan. They live in the same hotels, and there's a separate kind of, it's a different experience of traveling that you had when you were younger, which we're sharing.
You're absolutely right, and I think that's the thing. That's where I, you know, and you know, I've written about it this way. I think we at some point, you know, we became the foot soldiers of globalization. We stopped taking orders from John Lennon, and we started kind of taking our orders from Jack Welch. And, you know, a way of thinking that is the risk. I think there is a risk when cosmopolitanism stop being an attitude and start becoming an identity. Mm-hmm. And then once it becomes an identity, like every identity, you start trying to protect it and you tribalize. And I think that's what, you know, I think what's interesting, and I'm actually working on a research project right now. If you think of it, as you were saying, a nomadic elite is a contradiction in terms. Mm-hmm. But for the vast majority of history, elites were really not nomadic. They were nomads, of course, the prophets, religious people, the traders. But when it came to the elites, they were really the center of a stable establishment.
Yes.
Yeah. The idea of an elite that is nomadic is very contemporary, and it's also very questionable. And I think there is enormous value in that, which is you can really, you know, in the hopeful narrative is you have people that can transcend kind of territoriality and identitarian concern, like think of the bigger picture. But there's also the risk of, as you say, of being untethered. Mm-hmm. And the being untethered can be liberating, but it also can be confusing, can be disorienting. And, and I think what's interesting also that I think this is also transcending work. I mean, if I think of identity over the last, I'm not going to be one to complain about the trajectory of identities because, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, identities was basically ascribed. You were born in a certain place, a certain gender, a certain class, a certain family, and that determined your whole trajectory. Mm-hmm. And the last 200 or 300 years have been really an attempt to pry identity loose from some of those very strong bonds so that you could actually become who you are through reflection, to work and all of that. And now more recently we're discovering is there can be too much of a good thing. And I think it's because the two big signifiers of identity, the two kind of territories on which we put our roots, which for the last 150 years really have been the national state and the workplace. So you very often would describe yourself, like as you introduced me, like professor at INSEAD and, Sicilian in Europe or whatever, organization, nation state. And now we're really seeing the emergence of a group of people who actually move across countries, move across organizations. So it's really, the question is, what is the territory on which we ground our identity? And I think it's important for everyone for psychological, developmental reasons, but it's especially important for leaders and society. Like, what is that identity grounded in? Because if it's grounded in some kind of, nomadic tribe, which then kind of builds its own enclaves or its own bubbles or its own internal rooms, whatever you want to call them, then it sort of replicates everything, like cosmopolitanism becomes the same problem it was meant to solve.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
And how do you think that links up with the people's, like in the last 20 years especially, that there's been a real shift in how people identify around sexuality, around ethnicity, around there's been many subgroups of identity forming, people holding onto different groups around bio-identities and ethnicity identities. How does that kind of play out in your thinking?
I think the way it plays out is, like those other identities. Look, I think we all have two very strong, who knows, maybe genetic impulses. One is to be unique, mm-hmm. and one is to be similar.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think on very many domains, we have had more freedom to define ourselves. And not just define ourselves, but also really define the meanings of what it means to me. What being Italian means to me might be very different from what it means to someone else, and that's okay. And that's largely a good thing. But at the same time, an identity is meaningless if I don't share it with others. Mm-hmm. And I think even more problematic, sometimes an identity is meaningless if there isn't an other, someone who doesn't have that identity, or even better, if I want to feel more clear about my identity, if there's another that has an identity as opposed to mine. And I think some of this has also been made the increased plurality of identity, which I, for my ideology and for my cast of mind, I'm inclined to think is a positive thing, has also been enabled by technology, mm-hmm. which is, it's easier for me to understand what it means to be a certain way and to find other people who are that way and feel I'm not alone. And so that gives me comfort, that gives me a little bit of confidence in sort of coming out as who I am. Technology has also then taught us there's there's also the possibility that then we can basically tribalize around any identity. Yeah, if we have similarity between us, whatever us is defined, and difference with them. And I think technology is interesting because you have this incredible proximity without intimacy.
Yes, yeah.
So, and I think when people with different identities come close to each other without having the possibility for intimacy, then the next best thing, and they can't ignore each other, they can't be intimate, then the easiest way of relating is to fight.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Very helpful insights. Yeah, we are in a very important week. It's a transition in political life in the USA.
Yeah.
And you have tweeted quite a lot around how Trump is reminiscent of Berlusconi. What's your thoughts on that?
It's like I'm watching the rerun. You know, when I was a kid, we used to watch all the American TV series, and like that we had them in Italy like 10 years later dubbed. Yeah. And now I feel like I watch American politics and I'm watching the reruns of Italian politics in the 1990s.
Yeah. And how do you think this is playing out? What do you think is going to play out in the leadership of the USA and Europe with kind of this populist kind of progressive tribalism?
I'm really not, you know, look, I'm not a futurist, so I don't know how it's going to play out. But if we really take Italian politics as an example, I can't believe I'm saying this, then what we can say a couple of things that are more general. One is, you know, the tension between kind of populism, nationalism, and a more, you know, and a more inclusive, if you want, a more ecumenic, you know, a more embracing attitude, more open, maybe more internationalist, has always been there. And certainly been there in the US. I actually think, and this goes back to the conversation we're having about cosmopolitanism earlier, I think the nationalists have done an amazing job making an identity argument. While the people who are more internationalist at best have made an economic argument. This is like, you know, globalization is good for you, like eat your broccoli.
Yes.
You know, and they haven't really made an identity argument. And I think in the US at its best, at its most inspiring, right, is maybe one country which has made an argument for inclusion. Like it's part of its national history. And I think, you know, Biden is certainly going to try his mightiest to bring that discourse to the forefront. Like, you know, we are who we are because of who we welcome. But I think the forces of, you know, as you say, of nationalism, of, you know, in many cases of real racism, you know, they're still there. And I think they're going to have to wrestle with them. Now, on a more practical sense, you know, look, I think one thing that if there are parallels, and I think there are many between Trump and Berlusconi is, of course, over time, he will, you know, he might not be in power, but he will remain a powerful cultural force.
Yeah, he will remain
a powerful cultural force because it's almost easier to do what these kind of leaders do when they're not in power.
Yeah.
Because they're not constrained by even having to pretend to speak to everyone. So what you'll hear is, you know, what I think we'll hear a lot from Donald Trump will be the same that we heard from Berlusconi in the occasions where, you know, he lost the election, which is, oh, now I can speak more freely, which means now I can just really speak in a way that kind of amplifies the worst instincts of my base, that, you know, speaks just to the people who want to hear. But, you know, the sense of certainly, the sort of sense creating a culture where we feel, you know, society is fundamentally unfair, so you might as well try to get what you can.
Then
these leaders thrive. And look, I think we have to bring ourselves into question. And I've said this many times. I actually wrote it before Trump got elected. You know, those images of leadership we're talking about earlier, that's what gave us Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, we really kind of, for decades, praised leaders who disrupt institutions. And we almost made it a synonym so that if you actually attack institutions, you must have been a leader. Mm-hmm. You know, there were two pillars of our traditional view of leadership: influencing others and disrupting institutions. And so there you go. That's what he's done. He's influenced, very good at influencing others, very good at disrupting institutions. Sure. And then, of course, we realize, like, oh, maybe we need one of the reasons we have institutions, in fact, is to keep leaders in check from becoming, yes, you know, becoming intoxicated or intoxicating, mm-hmm, with power. And so I think what we're going to see is Biden make an attempt to revitalize institutions. But of course, to revitalize institutions, you have to humanize them. You cannot just give inspiring speeches about history. Mm-hmm. I think you have to prove, and I think this is, you know, what happened in Italy, what is proven to be right in the US, which is you can give, you know, you can appeal to our better angels.
Yeah.
But if you then don't deliver solutions that work, policies that work for the vast majority of people, then, you know, you will feel that you are in you are asked to choose between people who ask you to believe in institutions that work for you, or people who ask you to believe in the Messiah. And when the institutions don't work, the Messiah is very, very tempting, isn't it?
Very seductive, yeah. Bring on a savior.
Yeah. Bring on a savior. I mean, why not? Like, you know, it's what you have to.
Yeah. I'm not, I've been thinking a lot about the politics and also the parallels in corporate organizations I work in and in the banking system. And it seems to me that the populists were very successful at what we call effective politics, like playing on the emotions, really playing on people's identities, on emotions, very effective at that. And progressive politics, like you say, are more rational. It's like you do this because it makes sense. And that didn't break through. So it seems to be about getting some kind of balance. And this is in organizations as well. We flip between being very instrumental, do this because we're going to make more profit.
Yeah.
And then you get all the language around be more authentic, be kind and stuff. And it seems to be about trying to get a balance where people can identify with you and some rationality, some reasonableness.
Absolutely. I mean, I believe that's kind of the timeless fundamental tension in organization is that it's between the instrumental, we got to build a machine to get some stuff done, and the humanistic. We have to build a place where we can live and grow.
Yeah.
Okay. And come together. And I think one of the issues in many organizations and maybe in politics as well is that regardless of what we say, the instrumental is so dominant. And I'm not saying we should get rid of the instrumental. I think we should really get them together. I mean, look, I tell you how it manifests itself sometimes. You know, we all say, yes, we need authenticity. We need this word community. We need to build a community because it's going to be better for the business. And we do it too. We do it too. Even those of us who are more identified with the humanistic side of things, we often make an instrumental argument for the humanistic intent. And every time we do that, humanism dies of a thousand cuts. You know, because I think a humanism subjugated is a humanist that loses all kinds of value, because the value of humanism is to trouble you. It's like, you know, you and I both kind of interested in psychoanalysis. You know, psychoanalysis is not there to make you a better person. It's not there to make you a more productive person. It's there to make you a more troubled person.
Yes.
And through your trouble, to actually experience more life, relate with a broader range of people, be more solid in the face of all that life can be thrown at you. And I think that's the same thing when we look at an organization, their relationship with instrumentality and humanism, and say, like, how do we balance better? You know, there should always be a bit of friction, you know, and I use the phrase, it has to be a marriage of inconvenience.
Yes.
Where, you know, one has to trouble the others, but each has to have the ability to say, to stop. I mean, humanism is useful when it stops the excesses of instrumentality. And instrumentality is very useful when it can stop some of the sort of, the baroque excess that humanism can get into. And I think when the two are both are able to have, you know, to be in that tension, to be in the kind of productive frisson, to be in balance as you want, then I think what you have is a human organization. A human organization is not one where concern for humanism dominate concern. I mean, that would be a utopia.
Yes,
sure. Just like many organizations today try to be an instrumental utopia. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, utopia is always appealing, of course, because they're simple, because they have a single story. But I think what again, if you go back to what we've been talking about all along, what makes an, or just like what makes an, just like moving and exploring different places, different people can make a person broader, more human. Just like having more than one story makes an organization more human. And I think one of the things that we bump against in organization is the religion of alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, you can question everything in organization these days, but not idea that strategic alignment is valuable.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we complain like, oh, we don't have innovation. We don't have inclusion. What can we do to have more? I think if you look at a lot of what organizational development or coaching consulting gets brought in to do is to really kind of foster these days, either innovation, we want more creativity, more authenticity is a proxy for that, or more inclusion, more diversity and all of that. And we never stop to think that maybe one way in which you can get innovation and inclusion is stop being so obsessed with alignment. Because our struggle with being more innovative and inclusive is not a failure, it's actually a side effect. We are so successful in aligning things, which has to do with conformity, which has to do with streamlining, which has to do with efficiency, which has to do with instrumentality, that then we realize, oh, we've lost all those things that come out of, you know, that productive friction, a new idea, a different relationship, a more hospitable.
I 100% agree. I was talking to someone in the UN yesterday and saying the same. They're working on diversity issues, and it's like in many, many companies. They say they want diversity and they want conformity at the same time. They want one global culture. They want kind of this alignment, and the two things they don't get the tension between the two to understand what kind of working with difference, what it throws up, how it troubles you, how it enhances you, how you can use it.
I think we all want it. Look, I think we all want to have the benefit of a strong culture, and the value of diversity, and I think it's possible. You know, it's possible if you think of your community not as a tribe, but as a civilization. You know, if you look back, I mean, Freud wrote, I think everyone should read one book of Freud, which is Civilization and Its Discontent, which is not a psychological book whatsoever. It's a sociological book.
Yeah.
And he's basically mourning the end of a cosmopolitan civilization, which is Vienna across the 19th and the 20th century, and just looking at the advance of, you know, the most toxic and violent forms of nationalism that, you know, ever came to life in the last century. And what he's looking is at the idea that what he's saying is the problem is not wanting a strong culture. A strong culture can have a lot of diversity. The problem is when that strong culture becomes a tribal one.
Yeah.
Where we feel that the strong culture has to be based on a single story. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm afraid that, you know, world history has been, you know, a kind of moving of the pendulum between tribes that became civilizations, and when the tribes become civilization, when they stop exporting cultures and they start importing people to become, you know, more pluralistic, then the pluralism becoming unmanageable and threatening to some, and then those people wanting more homogeneity, and then homogeneity creating trouble, and people waking up from the nightmare of homogeneity. And, you know, and I think it's a little bit like, look, certainly this is from my perspective, and I know it's an ideological perspective. Look, the pluralism is a dream and homogeneity is a nightmare. And in every night, we all, you know, we have dreams. We alternate in the life between our dreams and our nightmares. The interesting question is, what do they mean? Why now? You know, and how can put ourselves in the conditions where and of course, because we are not asleep, what do we want to bring to life? Given that these are both part of our, you know, maybe biological, maybe psychological, maybe our cultural, maybe our collective human heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do we want to work for? See, we can be systemic and we can be psychodynamic, but we don't have to be fatalistic. We don't have to be nihilistic. Sure. It's like, what choices do we make?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really helpful. Jean-Pierre, we're coming to the end. It's been fascinating talking to you. I ask all my guests to just reflect on what it means to live a good life and what can we do to create a good society. And I think you've been talking about that anyway, but have you got any final thoughts for our audience? Big questions.
What it means to live a good life is one in which, at least on occasion, you can experience love and freedom at the same time. Mm-hmm. Nice. And I think that's tough. In many circumstances, we often find ourselves that we have to trade one off for the other, whether it's a friendship or a marriage or an employment relationship or a country. But to be able to feel attached and free, that's a blessing. And I think a good society is one that makes it possible for people to have that. And I really am with Winnicott here, where Winnicott wrote in 1950 this one of his less known paper, where he actually talked about the meaning of democracy. And he said, look, democracy is like the collective equivalent of a good family. It takes a lot of work and you just kind of enjoy it in a fleeting moment. But when it works, that's what it does. It kind of teaches you, you belong and you can have your own voice. Yes. And that experience to be able to belong and to have our own voice, I think responds to our, that most fundamental need I was talking about earlier, which is from the, our need for identity, which is a need to be unique, but also a need to be part of something. And I think it's possible to have that in a strong culture that's not homogeneous. If we, if we have a meta belief in a strong culture that is pluralistic. And so a good society is a civilized one. And then the good life you have is one, you can get some stuff done and, reap some economic rewards. And that doesn't come at the expense of, growing as a human being and helping others do the same thing.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and keep up the brilliant work, Jean-Pierre.
Really great to talk, Simon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.